Thank you all for indulging me this morning and being able to talk about dependent origination and nature origination. If you can't bring it up here, where else can we bring it up? And you might not hear this anywhere else. I never heard of it in 30 years of Buddhist studies until this year. It's not like the most prevalent teaching in the Zen world, but it's a nice model for how to talk about things. Anyone remember what these two are? Yeah.
Dependent arising is like more conventional, one thing based off of the thing before it, and that natural origination being...
Or nature. We could even say Buddha nature origination.
Being from Buddha nature, everything being a manifestation of Buddha nature.
Yeah. Nice.
Where did you hear about it in the last year?
Through this teaching of Sung Mi, this Zen ancestor Sung Mi, where there's quite a few books on Sung Mi that I hadn't really heard of him before, but he was, you know, especially around all these subtlety of models and so on, he was really into all that. And maybe he's not so popular as the other Tang Dynasty Zen teachers because he's kind of wordy. He was around the same time when people like Matsu was saying, mind itself is Buddha, that's it. And you know, those are, it's a little more accessible and pithy, right? Sung Mi is like, well, let's actually explore exactly what that means, you know, and an explanation. And so part of the Zen style was not explaining too much. And Sung Mi was like one of these early Zen teachers who was willing to try to explain what these things meant. So, like you said, dependent origination is things are arising dependent on other things, whereas nature arising is things are arising as manifestations of Buddha nature, as you said, which is a little different than saying they arise dependent on Buddha nature. Even though this story of Kapimala, there is a character for dependence in there. I think the problem with saying things arise dependent on Buddha nature is that then there's some interdependent relationship with things and the knowing of them, whereas manifestation just means that these things actually are Buddha nature. It's more intimate than saying they depend on. Does that make sense? Depend on means like there's two phenomena that depend on each other, and they're interdependent, so that's pretty intimate, but it's not as intimate as saying these things are Buddha nature.
White on rice.
What?
Like white on rice.
White on rice?
The expression we use in the United States, usually in basketball defense strategy. Stay with them like white on rice.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
The white does not depend on rice, and rice does not depend on white. They're like two different ways of talking about the same thing. A little bit like waves in water, although in that metaphor we might say the waves depend on the ocean, but really the waves are the ocean. They're a manifestation of the ocean. Yes?
Seems like it also, his perception also puts Buddha nature at the core of everything, no matter what.
That's right. It is the essence of everything. It's the nature of everything.
So it's not dependent on anything.
That's right. That's right. It is, Buddha nature is not dependent on anything. If it was, it would be a phenomena that would arise and cease dependent on conditions. but it's not a thing that arises and ceases. It's independent, but not as an independent thing. It is everything. There's nothing outside it, therefore there's nothing for it to depend on. Yeah. So these are these ways of talking. I hope we can, it's nice to keep clarifying our understanding of the strange realm of Buddha nature that's not dependent on anything, and to keep remembering how what we're talking about is this right now, our actual ordinary awareness, without reifying our false imaginations of self and other, subject and object. Very ordinary. So in Zen, they call Buddha nature, in Zen and also in Tibetan Buddhism, they sometimes call it ordinary mind. Like, ordinary mind is the way. And it's, do we direct ourselves toward it? If you direct yourself toward it, you make it into an object and actually go astray from it. Well, then how can we know it? This is a conversation with between Nan Chuan and Zhao Zhou. How can we know it? Well, it's not a matter of knowing it as some object, but it's also not a matter of just ignoring it either.
Being it.
Being it. And we are it. So since we are it, let's be it. I picked up this book for some reason earlier today, and I just, the bookmark was here, and it wasn't really what I was looking for, but I thought, this is great! That's how Sashin is, right? I mean, it's right, just what we're talking about. But I guess in this mode, you start to see everything is what we're talking about in a way. But this is pretty direct. This is just Thomas Cleary's introduction to the Shobogenzo. Thomas Cleary says, Dogen's famous paraphrase of the scriptural line, quote, all beings have Buddha nature, unquote. That's it. From the Parinirvana Sutra, the Buddha says all sentient beings have Buddha nature. So Dogen's famous paraphrase of that line, all beings have Buddha nature, into all being is Buddha nature.
Being singular?
Yeah, all being singular.
So the is, activity.
Yeah, we could say everything is all being, which includes all beings, but all being is Buddha nature instead of all beings have Buddha nature.
Is that the translation that you actually get in the three different versions of Shobogenzo?
Yeah, if you read, this is in Dogen's essay called Buddha Nature, Busho, and I think that you will probably see it that way. He's doing some word play and with the Chinese characters. Basically, the Chinese character U can be read as to have or to be. But through the commentary, he's interpreting the sutra that usually people would understand, all beings have Buddha nature, to all being is Buddha nature. And that's the standard commentarial understanding too. And this is one of Dogen's famous moves about Buddha nature, to quote the sutra but interpret it in this new way. All being is Buddha nature. So Thomas Cleary says, Dogen's famous paraphrase of this line, all beings have Buddha nature, into all being is Buddha nature, might be taken as representative of the effort to resolve unintegrated dualities. Makes sense, right? If you say all beings have Buddha nature, it sounds like there's some beings that have something. Or if you say all being is Buddha nature, there's no duality there whatsoever. In his essay on Buddha nature, Busho, Dogen complains. Dogen complains sometimes. Dogen complains that portraying the moon disk, clear, empty moon disk, which conventionally represents Buddha nature, as an empty circle is misleading, because in fact all forms and appearances are themselves the moon disk of Buddha nature. Dogen's talking about, he saw these paintings of the Zen ancestors, and one of them was painted as an empty moon disk to show how that person is nothing but empty Buddha nature. And Dogen says, it shouldn't be painted as an empty circle, it should be painted as that person, because that person is Buddha nature. Their human face is Buddha nature. Yeah? So Dogen complains that portraying this empty moon disk, which conventionally represents Buddha nature, as an empty circle is misleading, because in fact all forms and appearances are themselves the moon disk of empty Buddha nature. Here he addresses the philosophical and meditative error of imagining Buddha nature as like a soul or spirit separate from the body and distinct from the total field of experience, a realm of clarity divorced from the everyday world. Such a realm of clarity is a mental object, a state cultivated by concentration, and whatever its value as a temporary tool may be, it's not true realization of the all-embracing awareness of enlightenment. Nice. Do you follow that? It's a long...
The last one,
So it's not like Buddha nature is not like a soul or a spirit separate from the everyday world, which may be, we were talking earlier about the Hindu or Vedanta Atman. It may be that sometimes that implication starts to seep in there. There's this pure, Atman that we're actually trying to eliminate everything other than that. At least in dualistic Vedantic traditions, I think it is like that. Actually, you're trying to actualize Atman as separate from your deluded being, right? Yeah. So that's a little dualistic. I think Advaita Vedanta, which means non-dual Vedanta, is a little bit more like all the manifestations are it. The last part was, this realm of clarity separate from the everyday world if there was such a thing, that would be a mental object or a state. A state cultivated by concentration, which may be valuable as a tool, but it's not true realization of the all-embracing awareness of enlightenment, in which total delusion is included in the all-embracing awareness. Everything is included. And it's not a state. I was talking with someone about if we talk about enlightenment experiences, that's not what Dogen's understanding of enlightenment is, not an experience. It's not a state or an experience. But we could say, amazingly, that enlightenment is the ever-present experiencing of clarity and dullness and distraction and greed, hate, and delusion and love and compassion. All those, the awareness that's manifesting all those states, we could say, that's here right now, that one's enlightenment. You could say, and it's this ordinary mind. But then there's this issue of recognition. Do we appreciate the enlightened quality of this ordinary awareness? Meaning, enlightened, meaning like it's completely free from suffering, right in the midst of suffering. It's completely free from striving and grasping right in the midst of what manifests as striving and grasping.
Free of imputation.
Free of imputation. Even in the midst of imputing it with names like Buddha Nature and Tathagatagarbha, it's free of all those names. It's manifesting those names, even.
One other way of expressing it is ground of being.
The ground of being, yeah.
Or it's really the ground of being and not being. Really both.
Yeah. I think the ground of being maybe even appears in this, in our present chapter.
Yeah.
That, yeah, the ground of being and not being. Mm-hmm. It is the ground. Which is the ground is like the basis for everything. Yeah.
Can't put it into words.
Yeah. In Zen, sometimes they call it the mind ground, which is a little different than just mind. It's the ground of mind, or the nature of mind, or essence of mind, which maybe sound, maybe gets a little too reified.
But then you're separating mind from being by saying the ground of mind as opposed to the mind of being.
You know, mind, ground. Yeah, mind and being, no, there's no difference.
Mind is more limited than being.
Maybe. Or maybe being's more limited than mind. But the ground is unlimited.
Yeah.
And this word nature, you know, it really, it's an interesting word, and I think nature really is the best translation of this Chinese character. Sometimes maybe people use essence, but nature is almost universal. And in fact, in the ocean of Buddha nature, as the chapter goes on and elsewhere too, Dogen and Keizan just talk about the ocean of nature. They leave out Buddha. And it's just that this word nature became so popular that you can just, when the word nature is used, it means nature of mind or nature of Buddha. And why nature? In English, it's a word we don't use that much. And maybe just a hint about it is the etymology of the Chinese character shou, as in bu shou, or a different one than shobogenzo, but a ho shou is dharma nature. This shou is made up of two characters. One is mind or heart, and one is life. So the etymology of Chinese word nature is almost like the heart of life, or the life of the heart, or mind life, something like this. Maybe like the heart of life in a way. You know, you combine those two into one character, and it means nature. This is long before Buddhism, this character was around.
So, earlier today you were talking about the knowing. And just knowing without needing an object.
Yeah.
Without needing a bird.
Yeah.
The sound.
Mm-hmm.
And then you just said...
Because meeting means something separate. Mm-hmm.
And then you just said that it's not a state.
Knowing, yeah.
Knowing's not a state.
That's right.
So when
you could say it's the ground of all states.
So when you're in deep dreamless sleep, is that just the knowing?
Yeah, I wouldn't call that a state, right?
So that's not a state. But
I think
you experienced that there was an absence of body and mind.
Well, after the fact, you experience it. You can say that was deep sleep. But if we're talking about the deep sleep where there's no conscious activity, then we don't really call it a mind state.
It's more like after you're dead.
It's like after you're dead, yeah.
Then you're definitely not.
Pretty similar, yeah. Yeah. And, yeah. Does that make sense?
Does that depend on the...
Well,
you're in the bar, yeah.
But your brain certainly isn't thinking about it.
Basically, there's no experience happening in deep sleep, right? I would equate like a mind state with an experience of some kind.
So people, there are people that talk about being aware in deep sleep.
Oh, I was hoping you weren't going to ask that. yeah, because that makes the conversation a little trickier, right? Because you could say, then I think we're talking about just direct recognition of awareness itself without any other manifestation. So it's like being aware with, and usually we're like right now, I would propose we are aware of being aware at the same time as we're aware of what seem to be objects. And Buddhist tradition sometimes they call it this, like, the self-aware direct valid cognition. And they say that's every moment. There's a self-aware direct valid cognition. And then there's also cognitions of objects and so on. And from this Buddha nature perspective, we could say actually what the cognition of objects is, when we start investigating, we see the objects are themselves just the knowing. This is the way we've been talking, right? So then we say, actually, there's nothing other than this self-aware cognition. We seem to be looking at an altar, but actually, we're looking at ourself. Right? So in that way, you could say, everything, there's nothing but self-awareness. And you could say that is, there's nothing but self-awareness always, but sometimes it appears to be like something separate, but in deep dreamless sleep, then there's just self-awareness of itself, self-enjoyment, samadhi, enjoying itself, but with no rocks, tiles, and pebbles appearing at that time. And then you could say, if there's some sense of like a little voice at that time of deep sleep that goes like, wow, I'm actually like aware in the deep sleep. Then it's a mind state or experience, and it's a little bit dualistic, or it's a little bit like there's something extra. Or if we feel like I got it, I recognize it. So it's a little bit hard to talk about, but what exactly that is, the awareness of deep sleep, right? Without a sense of a self being aware of it. Yes.
Question. I have two questions, but they're probably the same question. So I'll tell you both. One is, why are we sit? Essentially, given what Dobin said, why are we sit? And then the second question is awareness of awareness related to Dobin's phrase, think about not thinking?
Yeah. I would understand that as one of Dobin's ways of talking about think of not thinking is be aware of being aware that which is not thinking. And how do you do that? Like without thinking about it. Beyond thinking, non-thinking. It's not like you can think yourself into it. Why do we sit? Why do you sit?
Why do I personally sit?
Yeah.
When I was younger, I wanted to get in line. Mm-hmm. And I kind of gave up on that. Now I just find it beneficial to try and perceive things without so many delusions.
Yeah, so isn't it even though we're opening to this realm, how it's always the same whether we're sitting zazen or in the midst of our busy life, isn't it easier to appreciate that fact when things are simple and quiet and still? So it's just like I'm kind of reinterpreting transmission of light as what's always happening, but this is a story about transmission of the appreciation of light, and zazen's a good in the relative world, it's one of those great occasions for maybe being able to appreciate it more easily. Conventionally speaking, I think so.
To your question about why do we sit, I was just reading recently John Dattawari, who said, it just made me remember, said was Zazen, the power of Zazen is that we get to know ourselves, and in getting to know ourselves, we get to know the other, and getting to know the other, we get to know everything.
Yeah, we get more intimate with ourselves, and we see ourselves includes the others, which includes everything. Yeah, that's a nice way to put it. Mm-hmm. Also, we can see like Dogen's understanding of Zazen is not so much like a causal practice to have a result, right? It's more like an expression of our inherent awareness or wakefulness. We're expressing it or celebrating it, or as my teacher likes to interpret, Fukan Zazengi, Dogen's meditation instructions. The gi can be translated as ceremony. So we sit zazen as a ceremony to, like sitting in a certain posture in a quiet room is it's just a ceremony to celebrate the zazen that's always happening. That's how Tenshin Roshi likes to talk about it. And the ceremony is a little bit like a celebration or an expression. And so in the midst of sesshin, after a few days, we might feel like our bodies is aching and hurting. We're so tired.
Pretty good time, right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so sometimes we celebrate it, you know, bearing great pain. But I think it's a beautiful way to remember, in the midst of the great pain we're about to give up, remember, actually, I'm just celebrating that everything is it. And this is it too. And if I feel like I can't stand this anymore, I gotta go, then we're like, you could say we're losing touch with the celebration, because we feel like this is not it anymore. I'm gonna go celebrate it with a good movie and a beer. And then we're like, because that's more of a celebration. So you can say, no, this painful body is just as much a celebration. Yes.
Anyway, yesterday in meditation, I'm struggling with my pain in my back, but I haven't been able to sit with kind of open legs, and I have found that really has affected the whole experience of meditation somehow. It's not getting my spine and my body in a certain alignment.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I did it anyway. I just did as best I could. I sat with my legs open. And it was amazing that it just literally sort of opened my head, and I was still having the pain in the body. But it was just part of all of it, rather than somehow I felt divided before. You know? Like there was my pain and it was me. And somehow just that physical posture.
Something about it.
Seems to be some kind of a shortcut.
Yeah.
Of course the Indians, you know, the whole Hindu.
It's yoga.
There's the whole Kundalini thing. So there is something about that.
Yeah. And you could say, from this point of view, instead of saying we're creating a nice posture and a way of breathing to induce a certain experience, it's more like the we're creating a kind of like a vessel or an antenna or something for awareness,
alignment
with
that force that comes down through. Our head and all the way down the
ajna, all the different. Somehow, maybe we're building a nice like camping spot for awareness to camp out for a little bit. We're like creating a nice. We're setting the table, and of course, awareness is already, of course, always camping everywhere. But we're like we do the ceremony of setting the table to more wholeheartedly invite awareness to residence.
Our practices, all these kind of rituals.
Yeah.
And they serve that, you know, like being the Doan. For me, kind of with not doing meditation so much, but doing just more practical kind of practices of just like sort of having to be on the spot.
Yeah.
Or is something that about that.
Yeah.
In these, you know, moment by moment by moment, you have to follow. You know, yeah. Well, whatever. You kind of keep back coming back to this.
Sort yeah.
Of brief moments.
Yeah.
Total kind of awareness.
Of course, all our, you know, conventional practices have evolved over centuries for this very purpose, and we can keep, you know, exploring them and seeing, are they really helpful or not? It's good to keep checking in. Some might be more than others, or some might be. But I like this idea of invitation. Like you could say, service or chanting practice is an invitation or invocation to all the Buddhas and ancestors, which is another way, a conventional way of talking about this awareness. We recite all their names, but kind of like, you know, Mahakashapa's awareness, come here now. Ananda's awareness, come here now. Shanavasha's awareness, come here now. And all of you join us in our awareness here now. All these ways of invitation. And, yeah, which is... I'm thinking like in tantric practice of both Hindu and Buddhist tantra, it's a lot of like inviting the deity, which is takes different forms, like Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are these beings, but they have different qualities. So inviting them almost like to take residence in us as our, they are our nature, but by inviting them, they become our nature. So we express, our body, speech, and mind as the body, speech, and mind of Buddha. That's kind of like maybe a summary of many ways to summarize tantra. But what we chant at noon, Dogen says, when even for a moment you express the Buddha's seal or the Buddha's mudra in your three actions, which means body, speech, and mind, then the whole phenomenal world becomes the Buddha's mudra, and the entire sky turns into enlightenment. That's very much like this tantric view. Like, when you express Buddha with your body, speech, and mind, then they become Vajra body, speech, and mind. They become Buddha's body, speech, and mind. That's one way. And related to that is this, since we were talking about this chapter of the Flower Ornament Sutra, I thought about the nature arising. I think this section of the sutra expresses this, what we might call tantric view or nature arising view. The Buddha says that the body of the Tathagata, so by the Tathagata, we mean the Buddha, and we mean Buddha nature, we mean reality of knowing. But the body of the Tathagata is present everywhere in all sentient beings, or as all sentient beings, as all things and all lands. So what's the body of Buddha? It's all beings, all things, books and tables, and all lands. All that is the actual body of the Buddha. Does he see how that makes sense as a nature arising teaching? That Buddha nature is expressing itself as sentient beings and as inanimate things like rocks, tiles, pebbles, and walls, and as lands and mountains and rivers. Right? All that's the body of the Buddha. And then the voice of the Tathagata, the Buddha's voice, is present everywhere also because it pervades all the infinite sounds. It has no creation and destruction, like an echo. So all sounds, the bird, sound of the bird, the sound of the truck missing its muffler, are actually the Buddha's voice, right? And then the mind of, mind, thought, and consciousness of the Tathagata are completely ungraspable because knowing is boundless. This is the mind of the Tathagata. And it's actually our body, speech, and mind, but we feel like our limited body, speech, and mind we identify with as this separate individual, but our true body, speech, and mind is the Buddha's body, speech, and mind. Like the sound of the car is the Buddhist speech, and when we hear it, that's like our Buddhist speech. And this room that we're in is our Buddha body. This is kind of like weird way of talking. Yes?
I can say this the way you were talking about inviting Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. But isn't it that they already are?
Of course.
Behavior, and we're awakening consciousness to that.
That's right.
And it's the words we're using. The sound impacts that the resident nucleus in our body to come alive.
That's right. The kind of tantric view is that we're already that, but then we do a ceremony or a ritual to invite what's already happening. And I think that's the view of our ceremonies too. And as we were just speaking of, the ceremony of Zazen, the same thing. It's a ritual ceremony to invite the awareness that's already here. But by ritually inviting it, it's a more wholehearted remembrance of reality.
The vitality.
Yeah, the vitality. And then there's traditions where there's very intricate rituals to do this invitation of what's already happening. And usually if it's, And that's the main thing to remember. If we think, actually there's some Buddha somewhere else that we're inviting to reside in us, that's a just dualistic thought. That's not it. But it seems that way in the ritual. Sometimes it seems like even what we chant before the talk, right? Of, may all Buddhas and ancestors who have attained the way be compassionate to us and free us. We're kind of asking these some beings to free us, but those beings are us. But it's a ritual to express our sincerity about that. Yes.
It's like you were saying about the altar. The altar is living in its dharma bliss of our seeing, hearing, and touching.
That's right.
And it has that kind of expression with the trees and the mountains, and whenever we give voice and appreciation of heart, they come alive through us.
Totally. That's like the Jijiyuzamai that we chant at noon. Today especially I was thinking, just hearing it in this light, and I almost started laughing because it's such an exuberant expression of the inconceivable unity of everything. It's like Dogen's just like, in his kind of manic mood or something. This is not just like sitting quietly. It's that too, but it's like, it's rocks, tiles, and pebbles resonating with us and us resonating with them, and like in this all, even though it doesn't appear within dualistic perception like that. So. You might have heard that the 13th ancestor in India was Venerable Kapimala. One time, Ashvaghosha spoke of the ocean of Buddha nature, saying, "Mountains, rivers, and the great earth appear in dependence on Buddha nature." So, I'm the kind of guy who has to like, wait a second, this dependence thing is a little too, does he really want to say that? So I have to look up the Chinese, right? And it has the character for dependence, but it also has, which is like the character A, and also has, it's three characters, also has Ken Ryu, which together mean established, or can be mean built of. So you could translate it as mountains, rivers, and the great earth are built of Buddha nature. Or that's what we like. Or mountains, rivers, and earth are established as Buddha nature. But it has dependence in there also. So we could say are dependent on and established as Buddha nature, maybe most accurate. Thomas Cleary translated as mountains, rivers, and great earth are established on Buddha nature. And Shasta Abbey, Hubert Nierman, translated it as mountains, rivers, and the great earth arise in accordance with Buddha nature, which is a little different than dependence. They are in accord with it. The manifestations are in accord with the source. And the three kinds of spiritual knowledge and the six supernatural powers appear from Buddha nature. And those are just part of the Indian story. The Buddha's night of enlightenment under the Bodhi tree, he had these three vidya, these three kinds of knowledge. And this is not just awareness, this is a particular... We might have, Tenshin Roshi likes to call them shamanistic experiences, which are the recollection of past lives, all these past lives going all the way back, was the first knowledge and the first watch of the night. And then the second was like the knowledge of how all these lives of himself and all other beings are completely dependent on karma. So it's also related to past lives, but how they arise and cease dependent on causes and conditions of karmic actions. So it's like, these are like almost like mundane insights, but they're pretty radical insights. I've heard, maybe Kurt has heard this, that Adyashanti talks about, he had this really, some profound shift of experience, and part of it came with remembering past lives. Which is a little surprising for Adyashanti. He's a pretty down-to-earth guy.
Yeah, somebody asked him about that because he doesn't really talk about reincarnation.
Mm-hmm, yeah, he doesn't talk about it, yeah.
And what he said was is that it was happening right now.
Yeah.
Like, so it was like downloading in the present moment. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like it was past life.
In the past, yeah. It wasn't a memory.
Correct.
Yeah, that makes sense, and because from the perspective of awareness, this is another of the many implications of it. Awareness has no past and future. Those would be like experiences. It's not even really now as a moment between past and future. It's actually timeless, eternal, beginningless, and endless awareness is. So that's why all the Buddhas and ancestors of old really are here now. I mean, they're not in a separate time in their Buddha nature. It's not like...
Because it's just all one.
Yeah, it's all one. Yeah, you can't separate into times or spaces. Yeah. So, yeah.
Dear, it just started bringing up this other thing earlier when you pointed to Kareen. You were saying, I'm Kareen.
Yeah.
Kareen's me. And then you were talking about consciousness. Consciousness and awareness, and kind of what came in my head is that consciousness, you're associating that more with the dependent arising,
mm-hmm.
and awareness, you're more associating that with the natural.
That's right.
So
nature arising, yeah.
Which made me think.
That's right.
Of, so. It seems to me that the consciousness is more local. It gives the illusion of our bodies just being so much more local, and it gets mm-hmm. more fixated
totally.
On this.
Totally.
And then I was thinking about how Ramana, so global awareness would, and Ramana, when he was dying, he wasn't eating, and his disciples went to him and they said, take some food. And he's like, I'm eating through all of you.
Nice.
So I just wanted to see what you think about this. It's like, if you were coming from a place of the global
mm-hmm.
awareness,
yeah,
like,
yeah.
no separation
mm-hmm.
or boundaries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
how would you experience more pain, maybe?
Yeah, sometimes.
Pain, but also people's equivalent joy.
Yeah, like in the Vimalakirti Sutra, they say Vimalakirti was this awakened lay bodhisattva, and he was sick. The whole sutra takes place that he's in a sick bed in his home, and it's because he's experiencing the sickness of all beings. So there's that part. And recently we were reading about the Buddha in the Sandhya Nirmochana Sutra. We were hearing how the Buddhas are almost like they have no personal intentions anymore. What they are is just a manifestation, just an expression arising due to the aspirations of sentient beings, of others. So they only arise in dependence on people wanting to meet the Buddha. They're not like, I'm going to go meet some sentient beings and help them now. Like, from this kind of inconceivable perspective, it's Buddhas, they don't have any intention to help beings at this final realm of Buddhahood. They are the response to sentient suffering beings. In a way that maybe we can't quite talk about what that is, but something, I think it's related.
Was that the Buddha? I mean, basically, he could have just stayed in Nirvana.
Yeah.
But he decided, no, there's beings out there that need me and want me.
Well, from this point of view, it's not really that he decided.
Yeah, it was decided through
it was, yeah, and sometimes, I think the sutra says, based on past vows, based on his past wanting in a conventional way, over and over, this vow of compassion, wanting to benefit beings, that when he kind of dropped away his sentient being, the illusion of being a separate sentient being, the effect of the vows kept manifesting as this compassionate response endlessly.
Yeah.
So still, Buddha's benefit, yeah, for all of us, yeah. Yeah, maybe the Christian story is somewhat similar to that too, actually, right? Jesus died for us and he continues to save us, something like this. So these three knowledges of the Buddha were these two involving past lives and karma, and then the third is the one that we're more familiar with, which is the end of all delusion. That's the third, vidya. So that's just part of the Buddha's, Shakyamuni Buddha's story. And then the six supernatural powers is this, again, part of the Indian story, the abhijna. It has that word nya in it again, by the way. Abhi is like, as in abhidharma is like, I think higher. It means like higher. So abhijna would be like higher knowledge, higher knowing. And that means these like so-called super normal powers. And they are, the six are these same three, vidya, these three knowings of the Buddha, plus clairvoyance, clairaudience, and reading others' minds. One of those many Buddhist lists. I think clairvoyance means you can see through walls, and what we call solidity, and clairaudience means you can hear things miles away, and reading others' minds means you can read into their minds, things that we don't normally do, but in the realm of awareness, it's part of the Indian, I think these are like pre-Buddhist,
okay. Yeah.
You know, things that the Buddha is like,
these are the traditional,
yeah, it's just,
things that you would achieve
after, that's right. So the Buddha's like, we got that too, but it's not the main point. So anyway, Ashvaghosha is saying, mountains, rivers, and the great earth are built on Buddha nature and these three kinds of spiritual insight, and these six paranormal powers also appear from Buddha nature. I mean, like, really, they're just Buddha nature. I think it's partly, as you'll see in the story here, they're just, they're not nearly as special and cool as Buddha nature. As ordinary mind, that's really cool. So here's the story. The stories are nice because they kind of like they're a different sort of mood than clarifying all this stuff. Kapimala was from the kingdom of Kashi or Pataliputra. I think we went through Pataliputra in I think it's the old name for Patna in India. It's one of the central hub cities for the train lines in India. In the beginning, he was a follower of non-Buddhist teachings, Kapimala. He had 3,000 followers, and he studied or penetrated all the different theories and the different shastras. He was like a great yogi and a great scholar of all different kinds of spiritual traditions. And the Venerable Ashvaghosha, from the last story, was teaching the wonderful Dharma in Magadha when all of a sudden an old man collapsed to the ground in front of Ashvaghosha's seat. There was an assembly there, and somebody walked up and just collapsed. And Ashvaghosha told the assembly, "This is no ordinary man. There's something different about him." No sooner had he spoken when that old man disappeared, and another man of golden color popped out of the earth in that place. Then the man of golden color immediately changed into a female, and he pointed to Ashvaghosha with her right hand, she did, and recited this verse: "I bow deeply to the venerable elder Ashvaghosha. In accordance with the Tathagata's prediction, you must expound the highest meaning of truth right here, now, in this place. So do it." And Ashvaghosha was like, "I told you he wasn't an ordinary man." As soon as she finished speaking, she disappeared. And then Ashvaghosha said, "So actually now, y'all, to let you know what's going to happen, a demon's about to appear and test his powers against mine." This is like Lord of the Rings. After a while, a wind rose, rain poured, and heaven and earth were darkened. Ashvaghosha said, "This proves that the demon's coming. But don't worry, I'm going to get rid of it." So Ashvaghosha pointed into the sky, and a huge golden dragon appeared, displaying great powers and making the mountains tremble. But Ashvaghosha sat solemnly in meditation, and the demon's axe consequently ceased. And all the thunder and lightning calmed down, and the rain stopped. He kind of tamed the demon, which seemed like it was this person, right? Transforming into a woman and then a dragon. 7 days later, when he thought it was all over, when he least expected, a small insect appeared, no larger than a speck, and concealed itself beneath Ashvaghosha's seat. Ashvaghosha picked it up in his hand and said to the assembly, "This is the transformation of the demon. He just wants to eavesdrop on my Dharma talk." He released the insect, but it was unable to move. It just sat on his finger. And so Ashvaghosha spoke to it, saying, "If you just take refuge in the three treasures, you will regain all your special powers." So the demon at once resumed his former shape, maybe as the original man that fell down there, popped off his finger and popped up as this man, and bowed and repented. In other words, I think that's how he became a person, as he took refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, which, of course, protect us all and are the give us everything we want. He's back. But now he repents and bows after this sort of magical duel with Ashvaghosha. And Ashvaghosha says, "What's your name and how many followers do you have?" The demon said, "I'm Kapimala and I have 3,000 followers." Ashvaghosha asked, what do you do with all your powers? What kind of things can you do? I mean, he saw some of them, right? But like, tell me more. What else can you do, Kapimala? And the demon Kapimala replied, I consider changing the great ocean or transforming the ocean to be very easy. Or another translation says, producing a whole ocean is pretty easy for me. And Ashvaghosha said, well, can you transform the ocean of Buddha nature? And the demon asked, what do you mean by the ocean of Buddha nature? I don't understand. And Ashvaghosha told him about the ocean of Buddha nature, saying, mountains, rivers, and the great earth all appear established from it. The three kinds of spiritual knowledge and six supernatural powers appear from it. And Kapimala, hearing this, here it says, aroused faith and was awakened. That's like these three characters. They're actually open, trust or faith, and awaken or satori. So it's like we could say he opened and trusted and therefore awakened. He opened to Buddha nature, trusted Buddha nature, and awakened to Buddha nature, realized Buddha nature. I'm going to skip ahead some because that's how it is. Kazan now is commenting and says, everything, even the smallest atoms, are all boundless reality, not at all subject to number or limit. So this makes some sense now from the perspective of nature arising. Is what's the actual nature of sentient beings and tables and books and mountains, rivers, and earth and atoms?
And demons.
What's their actual true nature? It's just the knowing of them. Yeah? It's just the Buddha nature. So therefore, we call, you know, our limited body and mind and limited tiny atoms are all boundless reality. Unlimited. So our what seems like our limited body and mind, its true nature is unlimited because it's made out of unlimited awareness. Right? Does it make sense? So this is like you were asking about the merging of difference in unity. This is one way to look at it, right? Is that unity is the boundless awareness that includes everything, unlimited, and difference is all seems so different from unity, right? But you can say all the differences are manifestations of this one unity, and therefore they are unlimited. The manifestations are particular and limited, but their true nature is unlimited.
The kai is the
merging or the harmony of difference in unity. So you could say, because the difference and the unity are not two different things, like the ocean and the waves, like the manifestations and the awareness, like that. Everything, even the smallest atoms, are actually boundless reality, not at all limited. They are like this because they are the ocean of nature, ocean of Buddha nature. Moreover, to see this present body is to see original mind. Original mind here means like Buddha nature. Capital M it has in the book to distinguish it from dualistic mind. To know this original mind is to witness or to verify the body, because body and mind are not two things. How can nature and characteristics be divided? So nature is Buddha nature, and characteristics is all the appearances of qualities of things, like the differences. How can nature, so this is the way that they seem to talk, like body And this all-encompassing awareness cannot be divided, because nature, the all-encompassing awareness and characteristics like the body cannot be divided. And I think Keizan's referring to this part in Dogen's Bendo-wa, where Dogen says, that body and mind are not separate. From the perspective of unchanging immutability, like true nature, all things are actually unchanging. And therefore, the true nature of the body is unchanging. But from the perspective of characteristics, everything is changing constantly. But you can't separate. Some things are changing and some are not. From the perspective of change, then actually body and dualistic mind are constantly changing. From the perspective of the true nature, neither body or mind are changing. So it's not like a body can separate from a mind in that way. Dogen says, nature and characteristics cannot be divided. How can you say that body ceases, but some conventional kind of mind continues? All things are just one mind. Dogen says this in a couple places. I don't know if he's quoting something, but he says this a few times. All things are this one mind, which is, I think, a statement of nature arising. All phenomena are this one. They don't depend on it. They are this one mind. How can nature and characteristics be divided, even though the demon revealed supernatural powers while a member of a non-Buddhist tradition, and that was not apart from the ocean of nature. He did not realize that it was all something called the ocean of nature. So he had these powers, but he didn't realize that they were all just manifestations of Buddha nature, even though they were.
When did that concept of the ocean of Buddha nature come up? That, in this story?
Yeah. Yeah, it's this story where Ashvaghosha is telling this demon after he repents. He says, the mountains, rivers, and the great earth are all established on the ocean of nature, ocean of Buddha nature.
Because the demon was boasting about his trick.
Yeah, exactly. That's what's going on here.
In reference to the trick.
Yeah. He said, what can you do? He's like, I can transform an ocean. And Ashvaghosa said, can you transform the ocean of Buddha nature? You know, well, what's that? And then we're going to see, of course you can't transform. Even the most powerful demon, nothing can change the ocean of Buddha nature. So even though his powers were not apart from this ocean of nature, he didn't realize that's what they were. Therefore, he doubted both himself and others. Moreover, since he did not understand these realities, he was not one who had reached the root or the origin. When he matched powers with Ashvaghosha, he was not equal to it. He just exhausted his demonic powers and found it difficult to make transformations. Just ended up as an insect. In the end, he let go of himself and took refuge in another, putting an end to contention and displaying true trust. Kind of like one translation even says he let go of his ego, this demon, where like I'm the all powerful transformation demon, but he took refuge in Buddha. even if you understand the true nature of mountains, rivers, and the great earth, do not get uselessly entangled with sounds and forms. Even if you clarify your original nature, or the original nature of the self, do not settle down in ordinary knowledge. Yet, even ordinary knowledge is nothing other than one or two Buddha faces or ancestor faces. So don't settle down in ordinary knowledge, but then Kaizen says, but even ordinary knowledge is just a face of the ocean of Buddha nature. Even ordinary knowledge is nothing other than one or two Buddha faces or ancestor faces, as are fences, walls, tiles, and pebbles. They're just faces of the ocean of Buddha nature too. Our original nature is different from the ordinary knowledge of seeing and hearing, and it's not dependent on movement or stillness. I already clarified, it's not dependent on anything, this nature. However, once the ocean of nature is established or appears as this world, then movement and stillness, coming and going, are necessarily connected with it, or we might say are manifestations of it. And skin, flesh, bones, and marrow are manifested when it is time. Speaking from the standpoint of the basis or root, which is Buddha nature, its appearance as seeing and hearing, sights and sounds, can be nothing else other than this root. When emptiness is struck, it makes an echo, and all sounds are thus manifested. This is, I think, probably Kaizen's quoting this part of the Jijiyu Zamai. It's like a hammer striking emptiness. Before and after, its exquisite peel permeates everywhere. So when emptiness is struck with a hammer, it makes this echo that pervades everywhere, and all sounds are manifested. It's a nice kind of way to connect this to that line that we chant all the time. And I think that has to do with, we were talking about time, right? We're saying that this is like these past lives are not some past time, they're all right now. It's like a hammer striking emptiness before and after, what we call before and after. It's like a hammer striking emptiness before and after, its exquisite peel permeates everywhere. So this one strike of empty Buddha nature permeates all of past and future. Do not think. So when emptiness is struck, it makes an echo, and all sounds are manifested. When emptiness is transformed, all things are manifested, and therefore forms are distinguished. Do not think that emptiness is not forms, nor think that emptiness is not sounds. So, as we were saying, when you see a form, it's just the knowing of it. It's not really a form. When you hear a sound, it's not really a sound. It's just Buddha nature. But here we can say, don't think that Buddha nature means that there's no sounds and forms appearing. We can call them sounds and forms, but what they really are is Buddha nature. When you investigate carefully and reach this realm, you will not think that it is emptiness, or that it's existence. It's not nothing, and it's not something. You will not think it's something which is concealed sometimes and revealed other times, or that it is oneself or another. What do you mean by self and other? It's like the absence of anything in vast space, or like large and small waves appearing in the great ocean. This is never changed in the past or present. Can going and coming be anything other than what they truly are? What going and coming, what are they truly?
Buddha nature.
Buddha nature, which doesn't come and go. The nature of coming and going is not coming and going. the nature of self and other is no self and other. The nature of waves is water. Therefore, when Buddha nature is revealed, not a speck is added, and when it's concealed, not a hair is lost. When Buddha nature is revealed or manifested, nothing's added, and when it's concealed or hidden, nothing's lost. When the various things are put together, it becomes this body. When myriad things are obliterated, we refer to it as one mind. Maybe we'd say, what do you mean the myriad things are obliterated? Maybe that's deep sleep. When the myriad things disappear completely, we just refer to it as the one mind. Clarifying the way and verifying this true mind should not be sought outside of it, obviously. But when the scenery of one's original ground is manifest, the scenery is the wind and light, the scenery of the original ground of the true self is manifested, it's called human or demon or animal. Zen master Shui Feng said, if you want to understand this matter, it's as if I am an ancient mirror. When a foreigner appears, a foreigner is reflected. And when a native Chinese appears, a native person is reflected. Dogen quotes that also in his Ancient Mirror fascicle. Also, Dogen quotes this whole story about Ashvaghosha and Kapimala in his Buddha Nature fascicle and riffs on it a little bit. So interesting that he brings up the mirror metaphor in connection with this story. I think it's so sweet because it fits very nicely, right? All things are established as Buddha nature. And then Shui Feng said, if you want to understand this, it's as if I am an ancient, timeless mirror. And when a foreigner comes before it, a foreigner is reflected. And when a native person appears, the native person is reflected. So to tie this in to this conversation, I could say, all the reflections on the mirror appear as nature origination. And by the way, Sung Mi uses this mirror metaphor in exactly this way, too. All these guys were like on to some kind of the same stuff here. So I think the mirror works perfectly to describe the nature origination versus dependent origination. All reflections appear on the surface of the mirror as the mirror itself, right? Their nature, what's the reflection of the foreigner and the Chinese person on the mirror? Their nature is just the mirror, right? That's the nature origination of these reflections. Their true nature is just the mirror. Their true nature is only the unchanging stillness of the mirror, made of nothing but the mirror. But each particular reflection, like now if the foreigner and the Chinese guy on the surface of the mirror are having a conversation, those particular reflections arise in their particular manifestations dependent on the other reflections. So this is dependent origination. Yeah, so thus nature origination and dependent origination function simultaneously without any hindrance, but there can be no dependent arising without nature arising in this model. Can you follow that? And that's what Sung Mi says. It's a little bit like hierarchical, like nature arising is the basis for everything. Everything is just Buddha nature. But then if we want to talk about how to how the reflections interact with each other, that's dependent arising. It's a boundless mirror. The true nature of all the reflections is just the mirror itself, Buddha nature. But in the realm of talking about manifestations and reflections, why do certain things arise at certain times? Well, dependent on other reflections. I think a nice metaphor for this point. And Sumi even uses it. Sumi might not ever come up, but he might again, but like just to, you know, fully tell this story of, maybe not fully, but another dimension of Sumi's story is he's really into this thing of sudden, the Zen teaching of sudden awakening and gradual practice, gradual cultivation. And his model, and he says other Zen schools have different models. Some say you do gradual cultivation, you practice for a long time, and eventually you have a sudden realization of Buddha nature. And he says, but really our southern school is the opposite. He says, we start with a sudden realization of Buddha nature, which could be very ordinary, like, is awareness present right now? Yeah, it is. When we start exploring it, like, and this present awareness right now doesn't seem to have, we can't find any boundaries or edges or center in this awareness. Might be like kind of ordinary, but that could be a sudden realization. And then based on the sudden realization, then we start aligning our whole life with this sudden realization, and that's called gradual practice, and that takes a long time. And Buddhahood comes kind of at the end. So the sudden realization is not like the end of the story, it's the beginning. And based on this new perspective, then we actually see if we can start, you know, seeing how our habits start to transform based on this insight, how our relationships start to transform. And this is a very humbling, long process, right? Because we constantly forget our realization. So we have to keep remembering and reconfirming the sudden realization. It's not a one-time thing. Over and over, we can remember the nature of unborn awareness and all its implications. We can explore more and more deeply. And then this long process of maybe application, you could say, but it's not exactly applying Buddha nature to everything, because that's like taking Buddha nature as some tool that you apply. It's more like the other way around again. Like, we're just integrating our daily life into the reality of Buddha nature, or aligning the expressions of Buddha nature with their source. Something like this. And so, Sumi says, the sudden awakening is based on nature origination, right? You realize everything is Buddha nature, and the gradual cultivation is based on dependent origination. So that's how he uses them together. Meaning, like, your conventional practices, for example, like sitting zazen in a nice posture, because those conditions create an effect of stillness and openness. That's just using the conventional workings of dependent origination. Does that make sense? Oh, so all these things, I love Sumi for this reason, because he like ties all these things together. Sudden awakening goes with nature origination, and then gradual cultivation goes with dependent origination. And these two work together, and dependent origination is based on the more all-encompassing reality of nature origination.
That's kind of the story of, how we talk about bodhicitta. And Dogen says, first you think you're just getting started, but actually you've had the entire realization. You're not, what are the exact words? You think you're far from the end, but
Dharma is already correctly transmitted. Yes. You are immediately your original self. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And that's what gets us into the door of the Zendo, where we say, okay, I'll sign up for Sesshin again. And I've got to clear my life, and my life is going to nudge me here. I mean, it's not exactly, but it's kind of...
And if we notice that we stop signing up for Sesshin, we're maybe losing touch with Buddha nature. It could be, so we have to do both. We have to do the clunky, painful work of Sesshin, but keep remembering what it's based on, or else it becomes like drudgery.
It's aligning ourselves with our original faith.
Yeah.
That we first saw.
Yeah.
Before we even got to 115 School Street.
Yeah, and you could say it's stabilizing it and letting it pervade our experience more and more deeply. That's the gradual part. And and if Sesshin becomes very difficult and we're about to leave, that's another time to wait. Let's remember our original mind, our beginner's mind, our this is all perfect, even though I don't think so. And maybe we really say, when we say it starts with sudden realization, maybe we could also look at it, I think, as like, there could be some gradual practice, then a sudden realization, and then true ongoing gradual practice based on that. I mean, there were people like the sixth ancestor, who seen before he had any Zen practice, had this sudden awakening in the marketplace. So for some of us, it's like that too. It gets us into Zen practice. But sometimes we do a lot of Zen practice. Although I don't know if we can do a lot of Zen practice without some understanding, right? You know, we can't even walk through the door without some inkling, like there's something more to my life than meets the eye. So, to finish this off, Keizan says, all manifestations are completely this... what were we calling it? Dreamlike samadhi. Same thing from the last story. Remember that? Nyogen Zamai? Oh yeah. Maya Upama Samadhi. Illusion-like samadhi. Illusion-like samadhi. It's funny that Keizan was just... must have maybe read something about that. He uses it two stories in a row. All manifestations are completely this illusion-like samadhi and have no beginning or end. Therefore, when the mountains, rivers, and great earth appear, they all appear based on it. When the three kinds of spiritual knowledge and six supernatural powers appear, they appear from it. You should not see even an inch of the great earth as something outside your own true mind. Do not put even a drop of water outside the ocean of Buddha nature. Because you can't. So don't try. This morning, this afternoon, I'd like to say a few humble words about this situation. Would you like to hear them?
Yes.
After a while, he said... Even though the huge waves flood the heavens, how can the pure ocean water ever change? Ever change. Huge waves are overwhelming us with painful knees and nausea. But how can the ocean water ever change? The fires of California.
What was the question?
How to see that, what you just read in the relation to the fires.
Yeah.
The nature of fire.
Yeah. Well, everything, it's the merging of difference and unity again, right? It's like the fires, a perfect manifestation of the ocean of Buddha nature, and all the beings dealing with it are too. And sometimes these manifestations are very difficult, and so therefore we arouse, we naturally give rise to compassion and love and care for those beings because they are us. And the fire is us too. Those fire monks at Tassajara really like talked about it that way. It kind of amazed some people because they thought, this fire is the enemy. We have to fight it because it might destroy our home in Tassajara. But David Zimmerman, I think, particularly wrote a beautiful piece on the fire is our friend.
Welcoming the guest called fire.
Welcoming the guest called fire.
Well, like they welcome all guests through the Tassajara gate.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just another guest.
Yep. And if the guests get unruly, we have guidelines. And we tell there used to be this, in my early days at Tassajara, there was some like Lions Club or some big group of like 20 guys that would come every summer and have these huge drinking parties in the pine and stone rooms and just like
Tassajara,
like, and they get a little out of line. They get kind of loud late at night and bottles everywhere. And you know, we welcomed them. And you know, we try to tame them a little bit, but very gently. Tassajara people were, I think some people said, we should tame them more like this demon, you know, brought out his powers. But I think people are like, no, we got to keep our spirit of openness here.
And so like when Emma Osloin was threatened, they did so many rituals which would be like the manifestation of the power.
Yeah, these powers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the powers.
Rituals, everything has an effect, right? So everything that we do with intention has an effect in the across the reflections on the mirror. It has no effect on the mirror, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it has effect on the other reflections. Everything with intention. And because it's all, you could say, especially because it's all built of the same mirror, therefore us chanting something for somebody who's sick in Northern California or something like that is, how could it not have an effect? Because there's no separation ultimately between us. That's, I think, part of the power of ritual.
That's skillful.
Yeah. I'll just read this last one comment from Lex Hickson. He just calls it the ocean of reality instead of the ocean.
He has all the spiritual powers from all the spiritual.
That's right. That's right. And he talks about that a little bit here. He picks up on this Shui Feng story. Yeah, he's initiated into all these different traditions, spiritual traditions. Here he says, the ocean of reality, the ocean of Buddha nature, is a borderless mirror. The ceaseless waves on reality ocean are reflections in a mirror. If a Buddhist appears before me, I reflect Buddhism. If a Muslim appears before me, I reflect Islam. And he literally does, because he's like a Sufi master. But if I remain only an adept in transformation, merely playing multiple roles as Buddhist, Muslim, Hindu, Christian, Jew, my adept's ego will leap into the sky and expand, perhaps taking the form of an impressive golden dragon. When Buddha Ashvaghosha manifests simply as reality ocean, the huge dragon of Kapimala's spiritual ego immediately ceases its proud display. So that's nice. We can manifest in all these forms and traditions to benefit people, but if we get too much like, I'm so cool that I'm an adept in every tradition, then we're like the demon. Yeah. We get caught. Yeah. Yeah. By our limited reflections. Homage to Ashvaghosha, Anabote Daiyosho, and Kabimara Daiyosho, and his student, Nagyaharjuna Daiyosho. Homage to all Buddhas and ancestors, and we dedicate the merit of our exploration and conversation to them who are us. May we all together manifest as bird sound and fire, water, and cool, compassionate love for the homeless and worried. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to become it.